Welcome to Modern Signed Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Now, you have to dig pretty deeply into the superlative mind in order to find enough appropriate adjectives to describe today's guest, and they would still fall short. Quite simply put, Ben Boba has been and continues to be a force of nature in the science fiction world. He is the author of more than 120 works of science fact and fiction, former editor of Analog Magazine, former editorial director of Omni Magazine, a beloved memory, also the president of both the National Space Society, the Science Fiction Writers of America. He's written screenplays. He was a consultant on the film Repo Man, guest of honor at Necromicon not once but twice, and the 2000 Worldcon, has a doctorate in education, a master of arts in communication, and a bachelor's degree in journalism. He's taught science fiction at Harvard and the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, and if he wanted to, he could line up six different Hugo Awards he wants on his mantelpiece. His latest work is Apes and Angels, the second book in the Star Quest trilogy that began with Death Wave. It's bookstores November 22nd. We're very pleased to welcome Ben Boba.
Well, thank you.
Before we dive into Apes and Angels, I just have to go through some of the amazing, rich history that you've had. I'm intrigued to discover that you were a technical writer for Project Vanguard back in the 1950s and for Avco Everett Research Laboratory. Did you always have a desire to write, or did that come along later?
Oh, the desire to write was forced upon me in the 10th grade.
You became editor at Analog in 72 after John Campbell's death, and he'd been the editor since 1937 and famous for some of his enthusiasms and prejudices and for discovering and promoting some of the greatest names in science fiction. What was it intimidating at first to be thrust into that position?
Hell yes. I was more surprised than anybody when Condé Nast management finally decided to invite me to be the next editor of Analog. My first reaction was, I want to keep the magazine going. Mm-hmm. You know, without John, there was a real question. Could the magazine survive? Yeah. Well, it turned out that Analog's readers were very, very faithful and tolerant of small changes. little nudges in different directions.
But you opened it up a little bit more. Now, some of the things, have you published Fred Pohl's Gold at Starbow's End and Joe Haldeman's Hero with a first story in the amazing Hugo Nebula award-winning Forever War. Those have been both rejected by Campbell.
Yeah, well, that's one of the small differences between us.
Yeah.
But there were lots of similarities. I used John's career as a guide for my work at Analog. You know, John read all the incoming manuscripts. There were no first readers. And he once told me the real job of an editor is to find a good writer in a bad story. What he meant was that frequently, you know, first-time writers sent their stuff into Analog, or Astounding, as it was called when he started.
Right.
And the trick was these first efforts often were not really publishable, but if you read them carefully, you saw enough talent there, enough drive, enough ideas, so that the writer could develop. And John spent his life helping writers to develop.
Absolutely. I'm curious, in when you talk about developing writers, how much communication would you have with a writer when you felt that they had merit?
Quite a bit. We'd send letters back and forth. What I found was that many beginning writers really didn't understand what a story is all about, a commercial story, one that can be published in a magazine. And, you know, it's really very simple. But as Clausewitz said about war, you know, in war everything is very simple, but even the simplest thing is very difficult.
Yes. By the way,
writing is basically simple. You deal with a character struggling to solve a problem, and you take it from there.
And obviously you've done it well, because that's where they awarded you all of those Hugo Awards. Five in a row and then a skip. And I don't know what happened that year, but then the following year you got it back again. So I don't know. And then comes Omni. Big, slick, glossy, well-backed, opened the opportunities even wider. And I love the thing you said. It's not a science magazine. It's a magazine about the future.
Right. That was the key to Omni's success. There are lots of science magazines out there, and many of them just folded after a few months.
Mm-hmm.
But Omni... We attempted to show the beauties and the excitement of tomorrow, and I think in large part we succeeded.
I think I heard you, one interviewer, you used a culinary analogy to talk about other science magazines.
Well, if I did, I don't remember
it. I'll quote it then. It says, I tried to get across to the editorial staff that the public's conception of science is that it's like spinach, good for you but not terribly appetizing. Our approach was to present the future, which is like lemon meringue pie, delicious and fun.
Yeah.
I remember from the fan standpoint of a little dubious at first, because, you know, here's this a magazine. We're used to these little digest magazines and early on and very pulp paper, but a little bit nicer later on. But here's this slick magazine, the size and shape of Penthouse or Playboy, and indeed published by Penthouse publisher Bob Guccione. But it wasn't his baby. This was his wife's idea.
Yeah, Kathy Keaton.
Yeah.
She was the brains behind Omni. And Omni was really a dream come true. A big, slick, well-financed magazine dealing with aspects of the future.
And those of us who were fans, and there were many of us, I think it got up to like 700,000 circulation at one point. We opened it up and found like Gibson's Johnny Mnemonic or Burning Chrome or Orson Scott Card's Unaccompanied Sonata and Mr. Martin Sandkings. And I never can pronounce this guy's name right, but at the art of H.R., is it Giger?
Geiger.
Geiger, the same, like an encounter, the same guy who did the design they used for Alien and on that. So I guess you understand, as I do, the immense impact that that had on the public.
Yeah, we sold between 800,000 and 1 million copies a month. And the analysis was that each copy was read by 4 or 5 people. So that's... Wow. You know, 10 times the audience of the best-selling science fiction magazine previously.
But your experience there was a little bit different. You weren't able to be, you had a whole staff. It wasn't just you.
That's right. Yes, at Analog, when I wanted to have a staff meeting, I talked to myself.
Well, in this case, so the question is that then you have to really trust your first readers as the filter to find the things you're interested in.
Yes.
And that must have been an interesting process from that. So as an editor, did it make you easier for you to write and or sell your writings?
Made it more difficult. I just didn't have enough time.
Yes, indeed.
You know, writing is a vocation or a vocation that takes time, lots of time. And being the editor of a magazine, especially at Omni, took a lot of time.
Yeah.
So my writing output went down a bit. Then I just worked harder.
Yeah. Well, and then at some point you left Omni and went on to great and wonderful writing things. The Grand Tour series of novels set in the solar system. You write this quote, I love it, says, I write historical novels that haven't happened yet.
Yes. That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
And some of them have happened. You know, I've been at it long enough so that some of my early novels pretty accurately predicted what was going to happen.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite prediction?
A very general one.
Yeah.
We will survive. We will survive and thrive, and we're going to spread throughout the universe.
And it can't happen soon enough for me and a lot of us out here.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that if you're going to write science fiction, you have to know what science is doing. And you said here, poets who sing about the beauty of the stars without understanding what makes them shine and how they were created are missing more than half of the real splendor of the heavens.
Yes, I believe that.
And that was one of the joys, again, back to Omni, that was one of the real joys there in having high-quality science and high-quality science fiction together in one place. And I think, I don't know, if that influenced you in having access to all of that delicious stuff and helping you, your own writing from that.
A writer uses all the material he can find.
Yes.
Everything around him is material. I remember when Keith Lomer had a stroke that eventually killed him. But the day of his stroke, I was in the car with him. We took him to the hospital. And as he's being carted off for emergency surgery, you know, half his body is paralyzed. But with one half of his mouth, he said to me, "Make a good chapter in a book, wouldn't it?"
Oh, my. Oh, my goodness.
That's a professional writer, as Casey Stengel would say.
And those of us who were big fans of all his Retief series over the years. I have this one off-the-wall thing. It says, you were an avid fencer and organized a fencing club at AFCO Everett.
Yes.
I'm thinking the only other science fiction writer that I can think of, as opposed to sword and sorcery writer, mentioning fencing was Robert Heinlein in Glory Road, in which he actually describes a duel with the guardian of the Egg of the Phoenix.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think there are a few other fencers scattered around the field. Uh-huh. But it's a wonderful sport. It exercises every muscle in your body and your mind.
Mm-hmm. And it's a sport for young people because it's very, very quick reflexes. If you watch Olympic fencing, they have to slow it down and show you what happened because you can't follow it fast.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a lousy spectator sport because it moves so fast.
Yeah. I remember fondly taking a fencing class in college and being very disappointed that there were no stone steps to fight up and down or chandeliers to swing.
Yeah. Every time I go to a new building, especially some monumental building, and I look at the staircase, I say, boy, this would be terrific.
It would indeed. Well, I suppose I'm having so much fun talking to you that we should talk about the latest book, which is Apes and Angels, coming out in just a few weeks. And interesting setup on this. Of course, this is following after the second the Star Quest trilogy, after Death Wave. And mm-hmm. To set it up, our characters have left the Earth to go to a planet where they know that this death wave is coming, and they're trying to set up shields to save the civilizations there. And our young hero is in conflict basically throughout this with a older gentleman who is running the show, and it feels that the young hero is a threat to him.
Yes.
It is intriguing because at one point I think you said that in order to write that you should be able to swap your protagonist and antagonist and still have a good story.
Yes. Yes. You pick your protagonist and tell the story from that point of view. But the antagonist, the bad guy, shouldn't be a cackling villain, you know, who's doing bad things just for the sake of making the plot go around. He's got to be a human being, too.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, you use multiple viewpoints, and you actually start out with a viewpoint of the antagonist. As you go through, and this is my interpretation of it, as you start, you think, well, this guy's just, you know, the older guy is just a nut, this Kossoff, and our hero, Brad, is, you know, sterling and wonderful. But as time goes by, he gets bolder and bolder to the point at some point you go, wait a minute, maybe Kossoff is right to have a check on some of this stuff because he's going so far out. That's an intriguing story arc. And is that something you planned from the beginning, or is it just evolve as you're writing it?
No, that was planned from the beginning.
Yeah. I'll take credit for it. Good, because it certainly works on multiple levels. You asked a couple of very interesting civilizations.
Just to get back to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
What I was writing about stemmed from my work at the AFCO Everett Research Laboratory, where we had a staff of really bright guys doing fantastic things, and a very charismatic leader. And sometimes the bright young fellows had to be reined in a little.
You would never have been one of those because you're a team player, right?
No, I wasn't one of the scientists. So I wasn't involved except as a spectator.
That conflict is also put together in other aspects. There are other people also who frustrate Brad, our hero, a little bit from time to time. But he does fall in love and gets married. A fascinating character that I would like to see more of, and Felicia, and at one point they engage in what you might call virtual sex, which is not graphic at all, but kind of, a moment there. And you've written about your very first book that you wrote and how the differences between sex and violence and their acceptance in culture and in writing is really intriguing.
Yep.
I think you said that you killed off half the people in the solar system in horrible deaths, and that was fine, but you couldn't have any sex.
Yes. When I started my first novels, they were written for a juvenile audience. Mm-hmm. And those were the rules from the editors. You can blow up a planet and kill billions of people, but no sex and no smoking.
No smoking. That's right. Forgotten about that. Oh, how times have changed, haven't they? In this wonderful book, there's I guess I want to call it sense of wonder moment when there is the two planets have a close enough pass that amazing things happen in transference between the two planets there. Do you ever sit at the keyboard and kind of chortle when you get a good idea and say, oh, that's going to be great?
On those rare occasions, yes. I do enjoy it.
what do you...
By the way, we don't use the word amazing.
Oh.
I worked for Analog, which was originally called Astounding.
and Amazing was Hugo Gernsback. Back. Yes.
Yeah. Amazing was a rival magazine. So around the Astounding, the Analog office, the word was Astounding.
I beg your pardon. Thank you so much for that clarification.
I used to twit my art director, wonderful man named Herb Stoltz, every time he would listen in on some of the conversations I was having with a writer, he would say, that's amazing. And I said, God damn it, around here it's astounding. So he went me one better. He started saying, the mind bagels.
Oh, jeez. Wow. It must have been a fun place to work. Even if it's very small office, you must have had a good time doing that stuff.
It was marvelous. And I must say, Omni was even more marvelous. As I've said earlier, Omni was a dream come true. And Guccione was the best publisher I ever worked with.
Wow.
He backed that magazine to the hilt.
And it paid off very well for him, and certainly for those of us in the audience. To go back for a moment to Apes and Angels, that the title refers to the fact that they talk about the civilizations they can contact are somewhere between the apes and the angels, because the ones below that would not be able to understand it, and the ones above that, we wouldn't understand them. So it's an apt title. What do you hope that the reader gets out of this when he puts this down at the end?
I hope the reader enjoys the reading, and if it affects him at all, maybe it will help him to understand what our own relations are with each other.
And that can get really interesting in the next few years. So we're hoping.
Always interesting.
Yeah. Let's see. What else I was going to talk about? Is there anything, any message you'd like to have for our listeners today?
Pick up the Ten Commandments and live them. We are a great and noble people, but unfortunately, sometimes we slip.
But if you take
a look at the long range of history, we have come a long way. And looking forward, we have a great future ahead of us. we are on the cusp of expanding beyond the Earth, of building an interplanetary civilization, and eventually an interstellar civilization. And I hope I live long enough to see at least the first steps.
And so do we. So do we. We certainly appreciate you have been most gracious today with your time and effort, and we really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Roger, you made it very easy.
Oh, thank you. That's my job. Our guest today has been Ben Bova. His latest book is Apes and Angels. It comes out November 22nd. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.